Go ahead and turn to Revelation chapter 12 this morning. Revelation chapter 12. We're in the middle of this survey of the book of Revelation. We've mentioned several times we're not going to be able to get to every little detail that we would want to, but we do want to give you the idea is to give you a structure so you can read this book and study it on your own. This morning we're talking about key players of the tribulation period. Last week we spoke about, or we looked at, really what boiled down to was the first half of the tribulation period. And you saw 14 judgments, seven seal judgments that the Lamb broke open. And that seventh seal, when he broke it open, it instigated seven more judgments in the form of seven trumpet judgments. And this morning, chapters 12 and 13 kind of act as, again, another parentheses in the book of Revelation, not so much carrying us forward with the chronology of the tribulation, but giving us more detail. So we're talking about these key figures during the tribulation period. I came across a really remarkable story this week. There was a pastor in the early 70s down in North Carolina. His name was Robert Nichols. He was voted in as pastor of this small church, and he and his wife had not been married real super long. They were young. They were probably in their early 30s or so, and they went to Sellerstown, North Carolina. Anybody ever heard of Sellerstown, North Carolina? Me neither. It's near Lumberton, North Carolina. All you beachgoers are familiar with that. So, almost immediately after this guy was voted in, an Antichrist spirit really embodied itself in the congregation in the form of a man. His name was Horry Watts. Watts was this powerful, well-contacted guy in the community. He had been a former county commissioner. While he was not an actual formal member of the church, he was a regular attender, and he had a lot of influence over this little church and got to really affect a lot of the decisions that were made. This heavy influence that he had kind of changed, though, when this pastor came in. This pastor was, he preached the gospel. He was very involved in the community, on visitation, and lots of people were coming to know Christ because of his ministry. And as this church began to take off, Watts started to realize that he was losing his influence in the church. At first, his animosity towards the pastor took kind of petty forms. He would, of course, gossip and kind of lay things in people's ear during the week. But during the church service, he sat back on the last pew, and it was a small church. It was pew number 7. And when he felt like the pastor had gone too long, he would obnoxiously hold out his arm and point to his watch. Glad y'all don't do that here. But when that didn't work, and it really never did, maybe the first once or twice, when that didn't work, he would make a scene, get up, make sure everybody understood that he was leaving when he slammed the big heavy wooden doors behind him at the front of the church. Still, after a couple years, the pastor was hanging in there because he felt like the Lord had led he and his family there, and things began to escalate because the pastor apparently was not getting this man's message. And so the pastor's family started getting anonymous letters with these threats in them, and some would say things like, you will leave Sellerstown dead or alive, whatever it takes. This man, it was proved later that he started calling the parsonage where the family lived. The parsonage is a house that the church owns that the pastor sometimes lives in. He would call the parsonage like 30 to 60 times a day. They would pick up the first few times, and of course, nothing but a little bit of breathing on the other end. And all this was kind of a form meant to intimidate the family. But the church was still growing. People were still getting saved. And these intimidation tactics that Watts was using ended up escalating to terror, all-out terror on the family. He had, like I said, he was well-connected. He had some lackeys, people that he would hire to do some things for him. They would cut the phone cord for the family. And there were times where he had had bombs actually planted outside of their home. Six times the bombs went off in the middle of the night. One time it went off near the bedroom of the infant that they had, and glass was blown out of the window, and there was shards of glass all around the baby, but the baby was still sleeping peacefully. When that did not work, the explosion started to occur closer to the church. And even one time, the parsonage had been shot up with shotguns and just sprayed all over the building and their cars. But still, the family really felt like that God had led them there, and that Satan wasn't going to be the one that led them out. So it all culminated on a summer day when a well-known alcoholic in the town burst into their home and basically went on a shooting spree. He shot the pastor twice, once in the right shoulder and once in the hip. While he was laying on the ground bleeding, he shot the wife in the middle of the chest, and she died as she was going towards her room trying to get help on the phone. What had happened was that the actual shooter, while he was a well-known drunk in the town, he had been manipulated by Watts, and Watts had planted these ideas that the pastor had been committing adultery with his wife. And so this guy goes over in a rage and murders Mrs. Nichols, and Robert would never be the same. The rest of his life, he battled cardiac issues, he battled severe nervous problems, and he would have manic episodes and spend a lot of time in hospitalization. In fact, he died at the age of 46, just 7 years later after his wife had been shot. For all practical purposes, what that family experienced was martyrdom. What they experienced was because of gospel ministry. So John made it very clear in 1 John, his epistle that was circulated to different churches. He made it very clear in that letter that there is a spirit of Antichrist that exists in our world. It's already here. That opposes Jesus, that opposes the gospel, and tries to disrupt the servants of the gospel message. But one day, although there are incidents, isolated incidents like this with the Nichols family, one day this spirit of Antichrist will take on its greatest human form of embodiment, and that is the Antichrist, who will be an opposer, he will be a fraud, and he will also be empowered by Satan. So in chapters 12 and 13, we have we're going to really look at four of these key figures of the tribulation period. The first one is the woman in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 12. It says, "And a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth." So right off the top, we'll go ahead and identify who this woman is. There's very good reason to believe that this woman represents Israel. That this is not a literal woman, but this is a representative or a symbol for Israel. And there's four reasons for that. Real quickly, there are, in the description of this woman, with clothes with the sun, with moon under her feet, and even the 12 stars, that this has similarities to Joseph's dream all the way back in Genesis 37, which was a clear symbol of Jacob's sons, the sons of Israel. Secondly, Isaiah describes Israel as a travailing woman. in chapter 26 and chapter 66 of his prophetic material. Thirdly, the woman was present at the birth of Christ. We'll get to that in just a second. We'll see the birth of the child who's supposed to rule with a rod of iron. But the woman was present at the birth of Christ. The reason why that is important is because some would say, would suggest that this is not Israel, or this is the saints of all ages, or this is the church. But it's difficult for this to be the church if this of the if the entity of combined Jews and Gentiles wasn't formulated until Acts chapter 2, well after the birth of Christ. And then fourthly, the woman gave birth to Jesus instead of vice versa. It makes sense for Israel to have given birth to this child who's supposed to rule the nations. It does not make sense if the church is supposedly the one that gave birth to Jesus, because Jesus gave birth to the church. It's the opposite is true. Jesus said, on this rock I will build my church. So the woman here we're going to identify as Israel. Second, we see the dragon. The dragon. And John sees a very fanciful and color vision of the dragon here. He says in verse 3, "And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads 7 diadems," or 7 crowns. "His tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. She gave birth to a male child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne." So in verses 1 through 5, what we see here is we see God is giving a revelation of the past. That is, he is presenting this epic war, this epic struggle that has occurred really since the fall, since Genesis 3. And God gave the prophecy that the seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. And so even since then, there's been this epic struggle, not only between God and the devil, but there's this epic struggle between God and the seed that he has selected among the human race. That is, the specifically the Israelites, the Jews. This dragon has 7 heads, which is probably 7 kingdoms, represents 7 kingdoms. It has 10 horns, which represents 10 leaders or 10 allies amongst those kingdoms. And then the 7 diadems is this picture of authority, that he has strength, that he has power. And we do know that the devil really is the prince of this earth right now. Right now. That's the qualification there. And he says that he saw this great red dragon, and his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven and cast them to the earth. To me, the best explanation for this is probably, this is referring to the fall of Satan, when he rebelled against God and he was removed from his royal and lofty position as the guardian of God's glory. And at that time, apparently many other angelic beings fell with Satan, perhaps even to a third, if that is indeed what this is talking about. So his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven. The dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, waiting, anticipating the birth of the Messiah, seeing how he could destroy this seed that was supposed to conquer him, that was supposed to crush his head. But of course, we know that never happened, even though Satan tried that at different times in Jesus' life. He tried to have all these babies, helpless babies up to 2 years old, murdered in Bethlehem. He tried to talk Jesus into just casting himself off the Temple Mount, off this cliff. And then I'm sure Satan thought that he had him whipped with the cross. But 3 days later, this was all part of God's sovereign plan. It had been foreordained before the foundation of the world that this was actually work in God's favor for the redemption of man and the glory of God. So verses 1 through 5 is referring to this past struggle. When we get to verse 6, especially 6 through 12, probably what we're seeing is this midpoint of the tribulation period, because you have this certain amount of time that is marked off here, 1,260 days. And it says, and the woman fled into the wilderness. All right, so we're here probably at the second half of the tribulation. The woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. That's 3.5 years. Now war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. So we know that Satan was judged at the cross. Jesus said that he saw Satan falling from heaven. Although the judgment was determined at the cross, the judgment has yet to be executed. So what this means is, if we take this in a futuristic way, in this passage, what this means is that Satan still has access with some level to the throne room of God and has some kind of access to heaven even today. When we read the book of Job, the sons of God came before God and they had to give an accountability for him about what they were doing on earth. And that's when that scene took place where there was this divine wager between God and Satan, when God said, have you considered my servant Job? So we know that Satan still had access at that time. The only thing that would have changed that is the cross, but it doesn't appear like, again, that judgment has been executed yet. So even today, as we speak, the devil has access to the throne room of God, accusing believers today. But we know that we have a great high priest, and his blood speaks a very powerful word over us. So there was this war at the midpoint of the tribulation. There's this war between Satan and Michael. Michael is associated with some kind of angelic protection with the nation of Israel in the book of Daniel. And the dragon is finally kicked out of heaven. And it says in verse 9, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent. Of course, that speaks to his character. The ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. So you're talking about this incredible, remarkable war and battle that takes place in heaven between the invisible spirit, or at least to us, these invisible spiritual angelic beings and forces that we don't see right now. But there's this huge battle in heaven, and Satan loses and he is cast out. And it says in verse 10, and I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. So there's this party in heaven because Satan has been kicked out for the final time. And so they say, rejoice, O heavens. But he goes on to say, but woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. So the devil at the midpoint of the tribulation, he's kicked out of heaven, and the only other place where he has activity is on earth. It's at this time, we know from the book of Daniel, in the midpoint of the 70th week of Daniel, that the Antichrist also breaks the covenant with Israel. And technically, if we want to get real technical about the, you know, eschatological terminology, the second half of the tribulation is what is referred to as the Great Tribulation, when Jesus was speaking in Matthew 24:21. And so there is going to be this escalation. You think things have been bad in the first half of the tribulation. The second half is going to be even worse because Satan knows now that he has but a short time to do his activity. We come to verse 13 and we see the second half of the tribulation. The past was in verse 1 through 5, the middle of the tribulation in verse 6 through 12, and then the second half of the tribulation in verses 13 through 17. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. Yeah, you think Satan is a humble loser? No. He says, but the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and times and half a time. There's that time period again. A time, that's one. Times, that's two more. And then a half a time, 3.5 years. It says, but the woman fled to the wilderness. She was escorted by a great eagle. And this is some kind of divine protection that God offers these targeted believing Jews at this time. Verse 15, it says, the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to help of the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. This may be a literal occurrence where Satan tries to use a flood. This might be symbolic language, just talking about the heavy persecution and the fierceness of Satan's wrath that he's trying to attack the Jews with at this point. The point is that God sovereignly protects these folks. Verse 17, then the dragon became furious with the woman and went to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. So at the second half of the tribulation, you have apparently this hugely intensified time of anti-Semitism. Now, it's not just the Jews that are going to be the target of this. It's also going to be Christians as well. But especially the Jews, because of this epic struggle that has always taken place in history. J. Vernon McGee, he said, from the brickyards of Pharaoh's Egypt, Haman's gallows, Herod's cruel edict, through Hitler's purge and to the world of the Great Tribulation, Satan has led the attack against God's people because of the man, Jesus Christ. And historically, we see this. Read just about any history book and you see a great animosity against God's people. So we have the woman, we have the dragon. The dragon is going to be the force that is behind everything else that's going on. But he's going to have his man. And his man is going to be the beast. Because if you look at the end of chapter 12, it translates this last sentence. And he stood on the sand of the sea. There's a little bit of manuscript disagreement. Some will say, and I stood on the sand of the sea, like John was referring to himself. It is more likely that he is saying, and he stood on the sand of the sea. So the picture is that Satan, after he's been cast out of heaven, he's on the beach, right? And he is scheming of what to do next. And so while he is on the sand of the sea, the next thing John sees is in chapter 13. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. So this beast here, I'll go ahead and give you the interpretation. The beast here, it is a kingdom, like a kingdom like Daniel talked about and the four beasts that Daniel saw in Daniel chapter 7. But this beast is also a man, because later in Revelation 19, it's the beast and the false prophet that are cast into the lake of fire alive. And it says the two of them. So this is not just a kingdom, but it's also a man. It's a person. This beast is the one that's known in other places as the little horn in Daniel chapter 7, the desolator in Daniel 9, the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2, the son of destruction there as well. And then 1 John, John has already referenced him in his writings as Antichrist. Now, anti, we think of anti as something that is on the other side. It's opposite. It's giving opposition, and that is true. That's definitely a sense of this word. But it's also anti or anti in the Greek also has this idea of in place of. So it can be a fraudulent character, someone who is a fraud. And actually, if you see the rule of the beast, many of the things, it seems like he is trying to step into the place of the Jews' Messiah, but actually be this key figure for the entire world. So he has seven heads. These seven heads, just like for Satan, these are seven kingdoms. Chapter 17 tells us that it's kings / kingdoms. And he's got 10 horns. And these 10 horns, 10 kings, 10 allies. These are some kind of allied confederation that are a part of the Antichrist coming to power. And he has not just come to power at the midpoint of the tribulation, but he's already set up this covenant, this treaty with Israel. But he becomes super empowered, apparently, at the midpoint of this time period, the midpoint of the tribulation. Says in verse 2, and the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. There's a possibility here in chapter 13, and I think it's chapter 19 as well, or 17, that there is a possibility that this Antichrist could possibly experience some kind of resurrection during the experience, which would explain some of the reason for the endearment to him. Verse 4, and they worship the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast, and who can fight against it? And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words. And it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months, 3.5 years. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. Not just the believing, revived Jews, but other Gentile believers. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on the earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Now, over centuries and millennia now, there have been many attempts to identify who this Antichrist is. There's been lots of suggestions. Judas Iscariot. Nero has been a popular one. The Pope, that was particularly popular during the Reformation period. Different Islamic leaders. Islam itself. During the Revolutionary War, one of the favorites was King George. Napoleon, Abraham Lincoln on the opposite side, Robert E. Lee. Mussolini, Hitler, FDR, Elvis, John F. Kennedy, Henry Kissinger. Some even like the idea of Ronald Reagan because, get this, he had, in each of his three names, Ronald Wilson Reagan, he had six letters in each. And at one point in his life, he moved to a street address that was 666. So obviously, it had to have been Ronald Reagan, right? Mikhail Gorbachev, Saddam Hussein, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump. All of these have been recommended. And in fact, I think once or twice at some point, I've even heard maybe Pastor Heath's name out there. Who knows? Anyone pretty much anyone who is charismatic and perceived as a threat has been identified as the Antichrist at some point in our life. And we don't know who it is. We do know his activity and the types of things that, he will do. We have the dragon. And then fourthly, you have the false prophet. In verse 11, this false prophet, some have identified the second beast as the Antichrist. But the problem is that the second beast appears to be subordinate to the first beast. So the first beast is the dragon, is probably the Antichrist. The second beast is probably what I'm going to call the false prophet. While that terminology is not used in this particular passage, it is used in other passages in Revelation. So we'll call this second beast the false prophet. And he is subordinate in some way to the first beast. So in verse 11, let's pick up reading there. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns, like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. Some have suggested these two horns symbolize civil authority, one wing, and then religious authority, the other wing. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. So this guy's whole life for existence, reason for existence, is to point people to the first beast, the Antichrist. Verse 13, it performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. This is pretty impressive. Verse 14, and by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. I think the best understanding of what is happening here and what Daniel talks about is at some point in the second half of the tribulation, the Antichrist and his false prophet are going to establish some kind of physical idol on the Temple Mount, probably in a renewed temple, for this Antichrist to be worshipped. And somehow this false prophet is going to be able to animate this idol to where it is going to really impress people. Verse 16, also it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Notice in verse 16 that this mark, he says he causes both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead. The grammar that is used is the word epi. It means upon. So the idea is that it is some kind of physical mark that is on the surface of the forehead or the hand. It's not, it doesn't appear to be under the skin or in the skin, but it is a visible mark. If we're just taking Scripture for what it is upon the skin. It is some kind of visible mark that shows that people are property of the Antichrist. Because this was, these marks, it's like a brand. It's a way of identifying property. Different property owners or even slave masters would brand animals, they would brand slaves with marks to show who they belong to. And so everyone that takes this mark is showing who they belong to and giving their loyalty to this beast, this Antichrist. And beast obviously describes his character. So if this is on the skin, this is probably going to discount some different ideas. This is not a vaccination. It's not a microchip, which has been a popular one ever since I've been alive. that people are pretty confident and dogmatic and say, it's a microchip. But this is some kind of visible mark that people willingly take. All right, I want to end real quickly with some application from this scripture. In chapter 12, we glazed over this, and I want to come back to it. In verse 11, it says that the accuser of the brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. This is not just an activity of Satan during the tribulation period. This is an activity of Satan, really, probably for all ages. Even he was doing it during Job's time. He does it today. That Satan, not only is he a tempter, but he's an accuser. He's a slanderer. In fact, that word, the devil, that description of him in verse 9, who is called the devil, that means slanderer, diabolos, slanderer. And Satan, that personal name for him, it means adversary. He is the enemy, not only of Christ, but everyone who names the name of Christ. He is a slanderer, an adversary. He is an accuser. But notice, and they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. So with this encouragement in the letters to the messages to the seven churches in chapter 2 through 3, this word for overcome / conquer is going to stand out in the audience's mind when they hear this for the first time. They overcame him. They conquered him. They had a decisive victory. And why is that? There's three reasons. And by the way, we overcome the devil the same way. These three means the blood of the Lamb. The blood of the Lamb is what changed our position. It changed our judicial position. But before we were sons of the devil, children of the devil, now we are children of God. We were slaves to sin, now we're slaves of Christ. We were sinners, that's what we were known as. But now we are justified, we are declared righteous. And the blood of the Lamb, not only for the tribulation martyrs, but for us as well, the blood of the Lamb is the basis of our conquering of the devil. But secondly, it says, and by the word of their testimony, an open testimony, that's the second thing. That part of the Christian experience is the Great Commission. It's sharing Christ. Honestly, if you claim to be a Christian and you're not engaged in the Great Commission, you're part of a very essential element. And an open testimony, that is witnessing, sharing Christ, sharing our faith. Everyone, and it feels like everyone and everything in secularism and popular culture today are saying that faith should just be a personal matter. It should be relegated to your home, to your place of worship. It should stay out of the public sphere. So in other words, what they are telling us to do is just shut up and keep your beliefs to yourself. So they'll say things like, what any religious tradition ascribes as God's will is no concern of this Congress. Just shut up. Keep it on a personal level. Nobody wants to hear it. It's not for the public sphere. However, verbally and publicly testifying about Jesus is an essential element of genuine Christianity. Number three, they overcame him by self-denial to the extent of martyrdom. Self-denial to the extent of martyrdom. It says, they loved not their lives even unto death. We know that Jesus said that his disciples should expect to take up their own cross and follow him. That any man who hates not his mother, father, his brother, sister, and his own life also cannot be his disciple. That's it's comparison. That is, our love and our loyalty to Christ should be first and foremost to anything or anyone else. And that's certainly true of those that overcome Satan. A self-denial to the extent of martyrdom. And really, that opening story that I told, it's a true story. And that's what happened in the life of Robert Nichols and his family. That they felt like God had called them to something, and they weren't just stubborn, they were obedient. And eventually died martyrs' deaths. I'm afraid that we have this misunderstanding of what overcoming the devil is. Overcoming the devil doesn't mean that life is going to be always be peachy. It doesn't mean that you or I are going to be relieved of that health problem in this life. It doesn't mean that your marriage is all of a sudden going to become easy. It doesn't mean we won't be persecuted, and it doesn't ought mean that some of us will not die. But we've got this image of Christianity that has been attached to the American dream that is totally misrepresented from the experience of first century Christians. And we have not evolved from where they were. The world is still the same. Satan is still the same. Overcoming does not mean self-preservation. Overcoming means faithfulness to the end. It is enduring with whatever that God allows in your life. That is a tough truth. It's a difficult truth. But one day when we stand before Christ, if these three things are true of us, of course, you can't be saved without the basis of the blood of the Lamb. That's first and foremost. But to stand before Jesus Christ, not just be saved and experience heaven for all of eternity, but to have Him look at us with pleasure and say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." And to divvy out rewards to each and every one of us based on our faithfulness. These other things have to be true in our lives. So overcoming is not just something that is done in this life. It really, ultimately, its application is it happens at the judgment seat of Christ. And that we endure in the here and now. All right, second application, real quick. God's justice is perfect. God's justice is perfect. In chapter 13 and 9 and 10, there's like this parentheses phrase. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. So he's drawing special attention to this phrase. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with the sword he must be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. What he is saying is that here's this declaration. It's been revealed that the beast's reign and rule is going to be horrific. It's going to be antichrist. It's going to be based on foolishness. There's going to be bloodshed. But he is destined for captivity. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. Or if anyone is to be slain with the sword must he be slain. This is actually a declaration of God's justice. And that God's justice is perfect. And it inspires us to endure and hold the faith, even when it seems like we're losing battles. God ultimately, and Christ as the King, ultimately wins the war. And we can be rest assured of God's perfect justice. We don't have to execute it. Our local government does not have to execute it. Our state government does not have to execute it. The federal government does not execute it. God will execute it. We can be rest assured of God's perfect justice. And this helps us endure and hold the faith. So, Jesus warned of many imposters, many false Christs, especially in this future time. But even in our time, there are many, many that claim to be special messengers for God. That is, they get messages that no one else seems to get. The Antichrist, when he comes, he will be brilliantly convincing. But listen, Jesus gave one dominant sign. There were a lot of things that would show that the time was just about ripe for Jesus' physical return. But Jesus, when he answered the disciples' question in Matthew 24, what will be the sign of your coming, of these things and the end of the age, Jesus only used that word sign in verse 30 of chapter 24. Listen to what he said. He said, "Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man." This is at the end of tribulation. So the sign of the Son of Man, the sign of Jesus, is not a what, it's a who. It's himself. "And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." So listen, the one dominant sign that Jesus gives about his physical return is that he is going to be coming on the clouds, and he is going to be coming with power and great glory, and no one will be able to confuse who it is at that time. While the devil and the beast and the false prophet will be able to fraudulently impersonate at times some of the things that Christ did, maybe even up to the point of a resurrection, Jesus will literally, bodily return. And at that time, he's going to execute perfect justice on this world. Amen? Father, thank you for the way that you open up Scripture for us. Thank you for your word. Thank you that you've given us some kind of expectation of your activity. You haven't given us every detail. We're not supposed to know every detail. But you have given us certain things. And Lord, for that, we are very thankful. And we know, just like in your character, in your person, in your nature, there retains some mystery that you are infinite. We will never fully understand you. And even when we talk about eschatology and interpreting things, that there's an element of mystery in some details. But God, we trust you in those blank spaces, those things that you have not revealed, those things that we don't know every detail of. God, we trust you, and we put our place and trust in Jesus Christ. And Lord, if there's somebody here this morning that they're just a part of the world system, and maybe they can't say that they've overcome Satan by the blood of the Lamb, Lord, may they apply that precious blood this morning, and that they would believe on Jesus Christ. God, thank you that we can open your word, that we can worship with one another. Thank you for the boldness that you give people in this room to leave the safety of home and go to the uncertainty of other countries and the uncertainties of traveling and everything right now, and to minister your word. Thank you for those nationals that are in the Dominican and other places. Give them boldness, God, faithfulness, perseverance, and endurance in the places that you have placed them. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen. Would you stand with us, please?